Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you are the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi, I'm Paul.
And I'm Erin, and we're the hosts of Lifetime Sentence. Do you roll your eyes when you see the words Lifetime Presents? Or maybe like me, you love trashy TV movies, but cringe when you see the words based on a true story.
Have you ever wondered what they got wrong, or maybe what they got right? Well, we've got you covered.
Every week I watch a Lifetime original movie based on a true crime and then tell you all about it.
And then I tell you the true story of what really happened.
From high-profile cases like Gypsy Rose Blanchard and Jodi Arias to crimes you may never have heard of, like the tale of the sinister minister.
Lifetime has covered them all, and so will we, because sometimes the truth really is stranger than fiction.
Listen to Lifetime Sentence on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or on your favorite podcast app.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well.
What's going on?
Summer's coming up.
Summer is coming up. Yay!
I know. I think my kids have 11 days of school left.
Jen, do you have any big plans this summer?
Why, yes, Cam. We have two very exciting things we are doing this summer. The first one is we are going to the Crime Con in New Orleans.
Wow. That sounds like a blast.
Oh, it is going to be so much fun. We always have fun at CrimeCon.
I think we're also going to the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago in July.
We are.
It's amazing. See, we already talked about this before we went on air. That's why we faked it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's so exciting. If you haven't signed up for either of them, do. It's so much fun. Well, I'm sure the True Crime Podcast Festival will be fun.
We've never.
It's first annual, I think.
Yeah.
And we've been going to, this will be our third year at CrimeCon.
Yeah.
Always fun.
It is fun.
Always fun. And Cece Moore is going to be there, which is kind of interesting because people in St. Louis are trying to get her to come here to help solve the Angie Houseman case, which we did in episode 9.
We sure did. We'll update you.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Yeah. Hopefully we can figure out our little recording devices and maybe we can interview some people when we get there.
That's pretty ambitious, Jennifer.
Well, or at least talk to people if we're sober enough to do it.
To talk to people and hit a record button. That's asking a lot.
No, Nico can help us.
Well, we'll be calling Nico.
He's our only hope. Help us, Nico. You're our only hope.
We're the friends that he never wanted.
Exactly.
And he kind of, you know.
Forced.
Yeah.
Yeah. His mom made us play with him. Yeah, or his mom made him play with us.
Exactly. And now,
we're five stage clingers. Or stage five stage clinger. Five. Yeah.
Got a stage five clinger, Bob.
What's your case today?
All right. It's a doozy. It is a local case here in St. Louis. It's kind of an older case, and there have been some podcasts done on this man. But I think I was able to find some stuff I don't think anybody else had.
Ooh.
I could be wrong. I usually am.
Well,
we
usually do really good research.
Yeah, we'll see about that. All right. You ready?
Yep. Let's go.
So many people fear going to the dentist for their checkups. Did you ever have a problem with going to
the
dentist?
No, it's the only doctor that doesn't weigh you, so I'm like totally cool with that. Yeah.
They don't really bother me too bad either. Perhaps it stems from a previous negative experience, such as your dentist hitting a nerve or that gnawing noise of the drill coming near you as you sit in the chair defenseless with your mouth wide open.
Oh, you know, when I was little, though, I had a pediatrician dentist that if I would cry, he would cover my nose and my mouth, get me to quit crying. It would suffocate me for a little bit.
I think that's illegal. So to borrow a quote from one of the best musicals out there, and I'm not going to sing, but you could if you wanted, but whatever.
I don't think I know this one.
You'll be a dentist
You'll be a dentist. You have a talent for causing things pain. Son, be a dentist. People will pay you to be inhumane.
Little Shop of Horrors. It seems that this man we're about to tell you about did take great pride in causing pain, and it wasn't in his dental chair.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's a Thursday evening in November 1977 when a vehicle approaches an Edwardsville, Illinois home located on a farm. The car with two men inside pulls up to the residence of the Goosewells. One man exits the car and knocks on the front door. Arthur Goosewell answers the door. The stranger informs Mr. Goosewell that he is from the Farmers Union, and Goosewell, of course, being hospitable, immediately invites him inside his home. Minutes later, shots rang out. Arthur and Vernita Goosewell lay dying inside their quiet farmhouse. Arthur was shot, and Vernetta was bashed about the head. The Madison County Police receive a call that a man and his wife had been shot and attacked inside their home. Paramedics are immediately dispatched to the residence. Vernetta Goosewell dies on the scene, and Arthur Goosewell passes later that evening. The scene is secured, and the Madison County authorities begin to search the crime scene and look for evidence. At first glance, the interior of the house was in shambles, and it looked as if someone had gone through it. So the police, obviously at first, thought, well, maybe this was a robbery gone wrong. With no immediate leads and coming up with nothing, the authorities call in the Illinois State Police. The community is reeling from the savage and unexplained deaths of such a beloved older couple. But no one is more devastated than their son, Ronald Goosewell, and his wife, Barbara. Police were working hard on the case, and they even attended the couple's funerals in an attempt that maybe someone would be there to give them some clues. Better, maybe the killer would be in attendance.
Yeah.
What the police did not yet know was that the murderer was operating nearby, and this case would catapult a tale that could best be described as a made-for-TV movie.
Ooh.
Which, incidentally, it was, and Corbin Bernstein played in the movie, but we'll get to that. The older couple didn't have any enemies in the area, and the only people that would be benefiting from their death are the couple's two sons. Each son stood to receive $250,000 as part of the parents' estate.
Wow.
But there was nothing to tie them to the murders.
Mm-mm.
Ronald's wife, Barbara, had taken out several life insurance policies on her husband shortly after they were married, and, incidentally, without Robert's knowledge. She forged his signature.
Ooh, sneaky.
Seems totally right, right?
Yeah.
Totally normal.
That's no reason to be curious about that at all.
March 31st, 1979, Ronald left for his job, just like any other day. When he returned home, there would be two strangers waiting in the garage for him, along with his wife. Shocked, and he looked at his wife as if to explain, what the heck is going on here? But it was too late. The shots rang out, and Ronald fell to the hard concrete floor. Still clinging to life, one of the men picked up a sledgehammer and finished him off. The killer then took off Ronald's watch and his wallet and placed the articles, along with the sledgehammer, into a bag. He then covered Ronald's body with another bag. There was a ton of blood on the floor.
Obviously.
So Barbara began to clean it up as the two men put Ronald's body in the back seat of their car.
So she wasn't even pretending to be tied up or kidnapped or anything. She was just there.
Barbara would wait a few hours and then call his job and say, Ronald wasn't home.
Oh.
Did he need to work late? ? Followed by some phone calls to some area hospitals, you know, laying the groundwork. Mm-hmm. Finally, the next morning, she would call the police. It had been 17 months since the death of Ronald's parents, and now Ronald is dead too. The two murderers drove Ronald's body to East St. Louis. They would park the car at a motel known for illicit activities such as prostitution and drugs.
Your house?
The
Is
old,
that where they went?
The old Inutel Motel. You know the Inutel Motel.
Cam's house.
They even put condoms in his pocket to make it look legit. 3 days pass without police finding the missing man when the hotel maintenance man discovers a body in the back seat of a car parked at the lot near the hotel. With no ID on the man, police run the car tags and find out it belongs to the man that had been reported as missing, Ronald Goosewell. The police believe that this man had been cruising for sex and was killed. However, this did not really fit Ronald's personality, so suspicion started to seep in. Could these three innocent people from one family die these brutal deaths all within the span of 2 years and not be related?
I don't think so.
There was no evidence to link them, but something was just not right, and police knew it.
Well, here's the deal. When the police looked into the family after the parents' murder, didn't they realize that the wife... Oh, they didn't check that out, huh? No.
I just gave that little extra info to you.
Because,
you know, he's dead. He can't say that he didn't sign it.
Right.
Or that he did sign it. As police were getting frustrated, a break came to them from a man already in custody. Andre Jones told detectives that his girlfriend had lured Ronald into a hotel room with the promise of sex. Jones said the plan was to rob Ronald, but he fought back, and that was unexpected, so Jones murdered him. The Illinois State Police closed the case on Ronald Goosewell, but still were working the case involving his parents. January 14, 1980, Sophie Marie Barrera left her St. Louis dental lab after working that day. She got into her car, turned the ignition key, and the car exploded. A call comes into the South St. Louis 911 dispatch, informing them that there was a huge explosion and it was a car still on fire. Authorities rush to the scene and run the plates and find out that the car is registered to Sophie Marie Barrera. The St. Louis Bomb and Arson Squad respond as well as the FBI agents in the area. Shockingly, the blast was so strong, it sent pieces of her car and her body over a 2-block area.
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine? Federal agent William McGarvey was called into the case. Now, McGarvey believed that the bombing was the work of the mob, the mafia. At that time, St. Louis had seen 21 people murdered over the past 2 years by exploding automobiles. Two operating outfits in St. Louis had been fighting over control of the unions and would often use car bombings as a method to get rid of competing individuals. This one, however, was different, mainly because the victim was a woman and she had no ties to the mob.
Mm-mm. Unless they mistook her car for somebody else's. But they usually don't make those mistakes.
As police are working the case, an agent in the room has a shocking revelation that leaves the room quiet. The man tells them that this bombing seems awful familiar to a bombing that had happened just 10 months ago in South City. On the afternoon of March 20th, 1979, the St. Louis Bomb Squad are called to a duplex on the south side of the city. Authorities take 7 sticks of dynamite from the backyard and bag them up for evidence. They also locate a homemade pressure switch that was made from a 6-volt battery. The devastation that could have been really bad and caused a fatality,
right,
only ended up a small explosion because it had failed. It did, however, throw dynamite and some debris around, you know, the yard. The resident of the duplex tells police she had heard a loud boom and it woke her up early in the morning. She took a look outside, didn't notice anything, so she went back to bed. She got up that morning, got ready, went to work. She said, after she came home, she saw some damage, and then she went to go look, and she had realized that was what she had heard during the nighttime. So she had called police. Police had come to her house. So they get there. They question her. They get all her information. Oh, and can we have your name? Sure. It's Sophie Barrera. So now it was clear someone wanted her dead, but who and why? So they tried to kill her 2 months earlier. Not weird. And failed.
By dynamite, too. That's, well, I guess if things are, yeah. And South City is like such a non-threatening area.
The day after the attempted bombing at her house, the failed one, agents visited her at her dental lab where she worked. They learned that her husband had opened the lab 27 years ago, and although they're now divorced, they still were friends and talked. They also learned that there was a dentist who owed her some money, quite a bit of money, for some lab work. You see, she started charging this dentist because his work was so shoddy with the implants and things that she would, it would take her time to redo it. So the police pay a visit to a man named Dr. Glennon Engelman at his dentist practice. But his alibi checks out and he's taken immediately off the suspect list. Glennon Engelman was born in St. Louis in 1927. He was one of 4 children that were born to a railroad clerk and his wife. Engelman attended and earned his degree from Washington University in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. It's a very fabulous school. Big school.
Engelman had actually attended college under the GI Bill. He was previously enlisted and was able to attend school and get his dental degree. He set up a dental practice in South St. Louis neighborhood. He was said to often treat poor patients for free. His first marriage to student teacher, which I love that student teacher, Edna Ruth Ball, lasted 3 years. After the divorce, he continued to give her money and they still had sex. That's a recurring theme with them. She continued to see him for dental care. That just made me laugh. I don't know why. His second wife was named Ruth Jolly, and they had since divorced when all this was taking place.
Like Mike Jolly.
I guess, yeah.
Wonder if they're related.
Although physically unappealing, I'm just going to go straight for it. He was not a handsome fellow, okay? No. But I tried to be nice there. Engelman had the strange sexual power. He was able to manipulate women, including some of his dental assistants that worked for him. He would get them to do what he wanted. He was very...
Was he charming?
Yes, very charming. He was sort of like a good salesperson. He could talk you into things. A sociopath, definitely. Yeah. But he always had lots of girlfriends. Weird. Back to the case. So with the nagging feeling, McGarvey sent the bomb evidence from each of the bombings to the lab, and it was confirmed. Bomb mechanics from both of the explosions matched. McGarvey dug deeper and found out that Dr. Glennon Engelman owed Sophie quite a bit of money, so much so that she was suing him to get it. The dentist hops it back on to the suspect list. Mm-hmm. So agents ask the dentist to come to the station, and he does, but he is not happy and he is not saying a word. He refuses to be tested for explosive residue. He comes off as rude, self-assured, and arrogant. Engelman does not offer a tiny bit of evidence to them. He tells police that they need to look into an ex-employee of Sophie's lab work and that the employee was angry at her for cutting his hours. Engelman supplies the police with an alibi, stating that he was busy with patients all day. Police decide to call in Sophie's ex-husband for questioning. He tells police that Engelman and Sophie were once really good friends, but that changed once she took over running the lab. He also mentioned a little something else about our dentist friend, and that was that Dr. Engelman was a suspect in a murder of a man that was killed about 20 years previously.
Oh, really?
Police pull what they can find on the James Stanley Bullock murder. Now, he was murdered, and it was very mysterious at the time, and the whole city was pretty infatuated with it. It was December 17th, 1958. Bullock was sitting in a car at the St. Louis Art Museum. As he was in his car, a person pulled up next to him and shot him 3 times in and around the face area.
Wow.
He was able to open the car door and escape. He tried to make a run for it, but he tripped and was then run over.
Oh my gosh.
The case at the time was a big one in St. Louis. And at this time...
That was like 1960s?
That was 1958.
Oh, 58.
And now
we're
up to 80. So it had been cold case for a long time. Now, Bullock was a newlywed. He had been married less than a year. His wife, Edna Bullock, was interviewed by police while she was still in shock. Police ask her if she's ever been married before Bullock. She bows her head and admits, yes, she had, but she had never told him about it.
No.
Mrs. Bullock said, she had been married 3 years earlier, but it just didn't work out, so they divorced. His name was Dr. Glennon Engelman.
Yeah, how do you keep that a secret?
At the time, police go to speak with Dr. Engelman, who had, by now, also remarried and was living with his wife and his mother. He tells police that he'd had patients all day into the evening, and the only time he left his office was to purchase a Christmas gift for his wife. With no evidence and nothing else to go on, the Bullock murder was at a standstill. Mrs. Bullock received an insurance payout of $64,000. But that's not all. It seems Mrs. Bullock took part of the money and then invested the rest of it into her ex-husband's business, Dr. Glennon Engelman.
That was quite a large sum in 1968.
Police learned that Engelman and his second wife, Ruth, had just recently split. And they want to talk to her to see what she has to say about all this. The marriage had ended about 3 years earlier, and it was a messy one. The couple shared a child, a 10-year-old son, and there were some custody issues, as well as a lot of hard feelings. Authorities hope that this will help Ruth talk to them and give them some information they desperately need. Investigators go to Ruth's house. They learn that Ruth still sees the dentist because they share a son, but she seems really nervous to tell them anything.
You think?
I would think so.
Ruth fears that Engelman will find out and she will be killed. Police work hard to win her trust, and they promise that they will protect her and her son. She finally caves. Ruth informs police that Engelman has talked to her about murders he has committed, some in great detail, others in just a passing comment. She also stated that he had threatened her, claiming that when their son turned 14 years old, he would kill her and take her son. He had said that a boy only needs his mother for the first 14 years of life.
Wow.
She was terrified of him and what he had done and what he could do, and mostly what he would do to her.
Exactly.
Ruth goes on to tell officers that it was September 5th, 1976, Labor Day, that she decided she had to leave him. She states that Engelman came home that day in the middle of the afternoon. Ruth was angry that he had not spent the day with her and their son. She said he immediately started taking off his clothes and began washing them. He told Ruth that he had just come from a quarry near Pacific, Missouri, and he had killed a man. Engelman, with a smile on his face, said he just shot him and made it look like hunters did it. The man's name was Peter Helm. The story was horrific, but if it was true, it means Dr. Glennon Engelman was a serial killer.
No doubt.
And that's something the police
wouldn't expect.
Was not aware of.
He sounds like a really nice guy.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm so going to him for my dental care. Mm-hmm. We should do a commercial for him. 26-year-old Peter Helm was married to a woman named Carmen Miranda Helm. The couple had went for a hike in the quarry area that afternoon, but only one of them would walk out. Police respond to a call that a man had been shot in the back, and as they arrive, he's barely clinging to life. Helm was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. Investigators interview his wife while still on the scene. She tells them that they were walking and a shot rang out of nowhere, and Peter fell to the ground. She told them that she didn't even realize what had happened. Carmen walked authorities to the location where Peter had been shot. As one of the officers looks up, and this gave me chills, he sees an X marked on the rocks high above in duct tape.
What?
The murderer marked the target spot in which to shoot Peter, just like crosshairs on a rifle.
Really?
Hidden under a pile of leaves, police find a bolt-action rifle with a telescopic sight. The rifle was tested, and it turned out to be the weapon that did, in fact, kill Peter, but it was clean of fingerprints. The serial number on the gun indicated that it was stolen. Without much to go on, police take a closer look at the wife, Carmen. Carmen, who was so upset by the death of her husband, had checked herself into an area hospital. When police visit her, she is being watched by her brother, Nick. Carmen tells authorities that she went to the quarry that day to explore caves and just bond with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Police also learn that Peter was heavily insured, even though the couple had not been married a full year. Carmen would stand to gain around $80,000 if her husband, Peter, died. At the time, they knew something was amiss, but they had no evidence to tie her to the crime. While police are now revisiting the crime scene, some things that didn't mean much during the initial investigation are now glaringly obvious. It's not looking so good for old Carmen, but it's about to get a lot worse. The investigators pull the police file, and while combing over it, they learn that Carmen once was a dental hygienist, and she worked for a dentist whose name is
Dr. Glennon Engelman.
Wow.
This meant that not only Engelman was involved in this murder too, but that his ex-wife, Ruth, was telling the truth about the murder. This was good, but they still needed evidence to prove it all out. Agents again reach out to Ruth, and they set up an interview with her in a nearby hotel room, fearing that she would be harmed if Engelman caught on. Ruth opens the interview by telling police about yet another murder. Engelman decided he wanted to open a business, a drag strip racing. I had to look this up, so I guess it's just like a strip, and then they drag race it, and that's a business, right?
I guess,
Welcome to Missouri, people. Eric Frey, a young man who was recently married to one of Engelman's former girlfriends, became a partner in his business.
Of course he did.
On September 26th, 1963, Bray was helping Engelman with construction at the site, as well as a few of the workers that he had hired to help out there.
Let me guess, there's an accident?
Drag strip.
Yeah.
One of these workers was Carmen's brother, Nick. Engelman informed the workers that there was an abandoned well, and he was going to throw some what? Dynamite into it, attempting to collapse it upon itself because it was a safety hazard.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a safety hazard is.
Dr. Glenn Engelman. Mm-hmm.
With the first attempt, the well failed, and it did not fall all the way in. Eric Frey then stepped forward and asked if he could give it a try, as he had had some experience with explosives from his days back in the military. While he prepped the second blast, the others took cover nearby. After the explosion, they call out for Frey, who does not answer. They find his lifeless body at the bottom of the well. The Missouri State Patrol come in, and they deem the death an accident. Just like the others, Frey's wife had a big insurance policy on
him. That nobody knew about.
And like the others, with part of the money, she invested it into Dr. Engelman's dental practice. A check was written to Engelman for $16,000. Shortly after all this took place, the drag strip went bankrupt. It was Engelman's first business venture.
And this was in 63?
And last, yes. Agents are shocked to hear the story, but Ruth is not finished yet.
Lord have mercy.
Ruth begins to tell them about a woman whom Engelman had known for years. Ruth told authorities that the woman once lived upstairs from Engelman's mom and said when she first met the woman, it was evident that she was more than just a friend to Engelman.
You say she's just a friend.
The woman had lost a husband in a violent death.
Really?
He was found murdered in his car in East St. Louis.
Say it ain't so.
Her name was Barbara Guswell. Engelman had told Ruth he and Barbara had planned the murder of her husband, Ronald. The police are in disbelief. Could all of this really be true? The specific gory details of each of these crimes let them know that Ruth had information that no one else could possibly have. But why is a man who confessed to Ronald Guswell's murder still sitting in jail if he didn't do it? Someone was not telling the truth, but who was it? Andre Jones, the man sitting in prison, Ruth, Engelman's ex-wife, or Dr. Engelman? Authorities also realize a snag with all of that they heard from Ruth. Can you guess what it might be?
A snag?
A snag, like a problem. I know you know what it means, but I was trying to think, you know.
Yeah.
All the murders that Engelman told Ruth about happened when they were still married, which puts into play the marital privilege,
mm-hmm.
meaning that it would be inadmissible in court. Police needed hard evidence to prove all of this. They mm-hmm. needed new information. They came up with a plan, but it was risky. They wanted to mic Ruth's house and get a verbal confession out of Engelman.
Oh,
Ruth
scary.
Was like, oh, hell no.
Oh,
nope.
No.
Nada. Nah, can
happen. I wouldn't either.
Nah,
no.
Nope. Don't come to me. Police then tell her how important this was to get Engelman, saying that he actually did all these murders, or at least one to start with. It would give them the evidence they needed. They also reminded Ruth that the only way she and her son would ever be safe in life, ever, is to get him and put him away. She relented and then decided to cooperate. So the agents mic her house, and Ruth is instructed on how to best get the info out of him. They decide to go in and ask about Sophie Barrera first, mm-hmm. as her crime is still in the news. It was the later one, and it could be an easy way to bring it up without being really suspicious.
Right.
They also promise that if anything at all goes wrong, they're going to be right outside her door, and they're going to have police all over the place. January 20th, 1980, Engelman brought their son to her house after spending the afternoon with him. They send the little boy to bed, and she begins to work on him, trying right. to get info out of him. Ruth leads him to the couch, which incidentally had listening devices placed underneath it.
Wow. Good.
She dives in and she brings up Sophie's murder. Engelman said even if he had built the bomb, someone could have planted it.
Oh.
So yeah. he was not saying that he killed her, even if they could tie him to the bomb. Right?
Right.
Smarter than he looks. He then added that now that Sophie was dead, he is $14,000 richer due to the fact that the lawsuit would have to be dropped. As Engelman and Ruth continue to chat, the police tap begins to go in and out. Police are perplexed as they hear a weird scratching noise on the recording. The police realize it, and they place a call to Ruth immediately. They tell her her dog is pawing at the transmitter. Yep. Could you imagine?
Yeah, no, that definitely is something Reggie would do.
That's why I thought of your dog.
Yep.
She plays it off like it's the wrong number, picks up the dog, carries the dog back to the couch, places it on her lap. Right? Uh-huh. You're not going anywhere.
I wonder what kind of dog it was.
Close call for sure, because if Engelman would have found Mike's in there, he would have definitely and immediately killed her.
He's insane.
So with that first police tap, they were able to get Engelman saying he was happy that Sophie Barrera was dead, but he never took credit for it. Right? He didn't plant the bomb.
Right. But he's happy.
Correct. So the police knew they had to try something new. They ask Ruth to wear a wire, and they hope that being out in the public where he feels maybe no one could be miking a public place, that he would open up more and divulge more. So they go out to eat. Police know that they can't bring up Sophie's murder again because that would be too suspicious. So they have to come up with something, and they got to get a little creative on this. Authorities, as they sometimes do, decided to have the police leak some information to the local news media with the hopes that it would mean that the hungry little news reporter would go visit him in his office and then run a story on it. And then that would be in the news. And therefore, she could bring that
up
to
him. Yep.
Just as planned, a news camera crew arrived to the Engelman dental office, and they ask if he had anything whatsoever to do with the murder of James Bullock. The next morning in the paper, it was out. Dr. Glennon Engelman was suspected of being a serial killer who was murdering for money.
Ooh, that's not just a little leak. I mean, that's pretty, that's pretty huge.
They did it, you know. Mm-hmm. Engelman is furious, but it allows Ruth that little opening she needs to be able to get him to come clean. So the plan is on. Couple go to a restaurant and police set up surveillance nearby. Knowing that Engelman thinks he is far more intelligent than everyone else, as most sociopaths do, Ruth plays up to that and asks him how he got so good at explosives. He tells her he learned it all from a man in the military back in WW2, and that people knew not to mess with him, especially Sophie Barrera. While this info was good, police still needed more. This time it was Ruth who came up with the plan. Just like spies of yesteryear, a good way to get someone to talk is immediately following a little boom, go wow, wow, right? A little pillow talk. So it seems that although they were divorced, Ruth and Engelman still would occasionally get intimate and have sex.
Well, of course, he did that with everybody.
And Engelman would sometimes talk about his crimes after sex. So police, with Ruth's permission, wire her bed and her bedroom with the hopes that a little freaky freaky will bring out his freaky freaky.
But all they'll hear is squeaky squeaky. Right?
As the police are setting up listening devices in Ruth's house, police are watching the dental office. And lo and behold, Engelman leaves his office early and then loses the police.
Oh, really?
That were tailing him. The officers are in a panic. The police then alert all the guys setting up the mics at Ruth's house, and Ruth panics. She manages barely get them out the back door before he's at the front door ringing it.
So he was there early.
He left in the middle of the day.
Afternoon delight.
Mm-hmm.
Afternoon delight.
Engelman knocks on the door. He had just dropped by to bring their son a gift. Mm-hmm. Couldn't stay long, he says. He left, and the police came back and finished up the sting operation.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't too long after everything was set up that Engelman comes over and the two have relations. And in bed, Engelman starts talking, but it was not quite what they were expecting. As the two are chatting, Engelman tells Ruth that she seems to be asking a lot of questions. At this point, he reminds Ruth that he was the one that did the electric in the condo, and he knew where every wire was located and what it was used for. This was his threatening way to tell her that if she'd ever consider trying to wiretap the place, she would be killed.
Right.
Police decide that they have to pull all the mics out of the house.
Of course they do.
Ruth, however, continues to work with them, and she starts helping them transcribe all the audio tapes that they've collected. While there was some juicy details, nothing was there to definitely link him to any of the murders that they had suspected him of. The authorities know that they have to get him out to a public place to discuss it, and they needed to hurry because he was getting suspicious. In the meantime, police leaked some more information to the media. This time it was about Peter Hom's murder.
Now, that was Carmen Miranda's
husband. Yep.
You know, a little sidetrack here. Ruth, could you imagine having sex with somebody not only that you divorced, but you know it's killed people? And I just,
creepy, creepy, right?
No, I couldn't do it. Sorry.
I don't know, though. Maybe she was just like, so scared of him.
True,
and I bet he was still giving her money, too.
Maybe. I don't know. But it's all tainted money.
Yuck. Valentine's Day comes around, and Ruth asks Engelman to take her out to eat, and he agrees. Spend the evening together. Knowing Engelman has been getting suspicious, they plan to go to a public place again with the hopes of him being more open, as in before. Ruth brings up the Helm News article and asks Engelman if Carmen got a lot of money from her husband's death. Engelman, now feeling that he was not being listened to, begins to open up. Engelman goes on to say that he was given part of the settlement and that Carmen's brother Nick gave him the cash. Ruth, in an attempt to get him fired up, asked if maybe they skimmed off the top and kept it for themselves. Engelman said Nick and Carmen wouldn't dare because Nick knows that I know a guy that will do a simple hit for $1,000. The police had Ruth ask him why all these people were killed. Why did he kill all these people? He said it was all for the money. Ruth, still trying to get him to say more, to say something incriminating, tells Engelman she's afraid that Carmen is not well mentally, and she thinks that she's going to blab. Engelman then tells Ruth Carmen won't talk because he and Carmen share a bond stronger than any sexual intimacy. He then looks into her eyes and says, Carmen and I have been homicidally intimate.
Bum, bum, bum.
I think it's weird that he equates sexual intimacy with murder. Weird. And there it is. The admission that Engelman and Carmen conspired to murder her husband and get money for doing it. It wasn't the strongest evidence, but it was the strongest they had. They began to work to put a case together. They knew they had to get the man off the street. So what they needed was a witness or an accomplice to testify against Engelman. Authorities know that Ruth and her son were not safe as they were getting closer to getting Engelman. So the two were given new identities and placed into the witness protection program. Wow. I know, it was pretty cool, huh?
That's very cool.
Authorities need someone to talk. They had an idea. They would arrest Engelman and the three he had mentioned on the wiretaps, which were Robert Handy, Nick Miranda, and his sister, Carmen Miranda. Robert Handy was the second man that was waiting in the garage when Ronald Goosewell came home. They would arrest all four at the exact same time to alleviate them being able to speak with each other and possibly run. Officers would then tell them Engelman was arrested as well and pushed them to talk. Here's my funny thing. So Robert Handy, his fake name, which I'm so glad, and this just cracks me up, it was Rick Carpenter. Rob Handy. Isn't that funny? Okay, Handy Carpenter. It just made me laugh because I was like, you know, that's what they thought. As is so often the case, one criminal can't go down without taking someone with them.
Of course.
Nick Miranda is picked up by the officers, and as he's riding to jail in the cruiser, he laughs to himself as he hears officers in California say they can't find Carmen at her last known address. The driving officer asks why Nick is laughing, and he says, Carmen isn't in California because she's sitting at my house. And thank you, Nick. Screech! Car turns around, and they go back to Nick's house to pick up Carmen.
Carmen.
So the plan to pick them up separately so they wouldn't talk failed, since Carmen and Nick are now in the same police Uber back to the station.
Right. But they can't talk.
No, they're talking, because at that point, he's just like, listen, but I didn't put that in there. At that point, he's like, you keep your mouth shut, because you will sing like a canary, and you let me do the talking.
Okay. I thought that they would talk about, okay, this is what we're going
to
say.
Well, kind of. That's what they didn't want to happen.
Exactly.
She was like a crying lunatic mess. So, February 24th, 1980, agents began to interview the suspects separately. Handy, who had been a longtime friend of Engelman, isn't talking. He is like, I am not giving up anything. Mm-hmm. So now they put all their hope into Nick and Carmen. Investigators tell Nick that they have enough evidence to prosecute both of them and put both of them away for a long time, if not life. Knowing that the Mirandas were close, they go in for the kill. They offer Nick a deal, his testimony for his sister's life. In exchange for talking, they will give Carmen only 22 years for conspiracy to murder. Nick shoots it down and demands immunity for both of them. And if they get it, he will see they both talk. You with me on that? Like, what happened?
Right.
So this is obviously a really tough call. Should the prosecutor let Carmen walk in exchange for testimony that will put Engelman away, or do they chance it and try to convict with no witness testimony? Knowing that they really didn't have a case without testimony, they had to have someone talk. They decided to give both Carmen and Nick immunity in order to get Engelman. Not what they wanted, but what they had to do to get Engelman.
It's the best of a bad situation.
Knowing he would definitely strike again.
Right.
The deal was now in place, and Nick began talking. He tells them that he had known Engelman for a long time and had heard about the death of his sister's husband right after it happened. Nick said when he heard it, he immediately knew Engelman was involved in several murder for hires. Police then interview Carmen to see what she had to tell them. She tells them that she had known Engelman her whole life and had always looked up to him. When she was about 18 or 19 years old, she began working in his dental office. One day, she told Engelman she was barely making ends meet and she just couldn't get ahead of her bills. Engelman told her he knew how to get ahead. He proceeds to tell her to find a man and marry him, take out several life insurance policies, and collect on them. Well, Carmen thinks this is a terrible plan because she doesn't want to wait until she gets old before she gets the money. Engelman then clarifies the plan with her. He tells her that he will kill the man for her because, after all, he'd done it before. At first, Carmen didn't believe him, but as time went on, the two began to talk about it almost daily. She trusted him and she believed him. She thought he was a really smart person, being that he was a dentist and all. And yeah, well, he had done it before, and he was still there to talk to her, so obviously he didn't get caught.
Who needs money that bad? Badly, sorry for the grammar mistake.
He told her that this was the plan. She had to find a man who was a good guy that worked for a large company with great insurance benefits. Carmen knew just the guy, Peter Helm. Peter and Carmen went to high school together, and Peter was now working for the phone company.
Southwestern Bell.
They started dating and soon were married. She quit working for Engelman at that time, but Engelman said, "No worries. When you're ready and all those policies are in place, you just let me know and I'll kill him." It was right before the couple's first wedding anniversary that Carmen called Dr. Engelman, saying she was ready. Engelman drove to her site for a rehearsal run-through, and the plan was in place. It was at that time that the X was drawn, and she was instructed to take him to that point. The day had arrived, and Carmen asked Peter to go to the quarry to do some exploring and spend some time together. He was then shot and killed. The experience was not quite what Carmen had expected, and it left her pretty traumatized.
Oh, I would think so.
She refused all the money, had Nick do the payoff to Engelman, and then Nick kept the rest for himself. She didn't even take a dime. Also, when all this occurred, she panicked. She like froze and she started screaming her head off, which this is like a little park area or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so Engelman had to like rush up to her and like kind of shake her and calm her down. Knock it off. And that's kind of where he tossed that gun in the bushes or whatever. And on her way out, she was panicking and crying hysterically and ran into somebody and said, "Call 911. So Engelman was there and passed those same people, right?
But they never guessed it.
Dr. Glennon Engelman was now going to be tried for the murder of Peter Helm. In September of 1980, the trial began. The prosecution had a little surprise in store. Ruth, who was now living elsewhere by a different name, came out of hiding to testify to the voice on all the tapes, claiming that, yes, indeed, that is Dr. Glennon Engelman. While he was on the stand, he was asked about the homicidal intimacy, quote, and he got very angry. The prosecutors loved it, and they kept feeding into it until his anger was full-blown rage. He exploded on the stand, and the jury witnessed it all. they finally saw Dr. Glennon Engelmann for the monster he really was. After deliberating just 55 minutes, the jury returned with a verdict of guilty, and Dr. Glennon Engelmann was sentenced to life in prison. His accomplice, Robert Handy, got 17 years. I wonder if he'll be popular in prison with a last name like that.
I would think so.
Following his first trial, he was tried and convicted of the murder of Sophie Barrara and received another life sentence. Prosecutors also believed he was responsible for at least three more murders, but there was still the issue with the young man, Andre Jones, who was sitting in prison for his admission of the killing of Ronald Guswell. So the police knew that they had to try to figure out why he would confess to this.
Mm-hmm.
And they really needed to know what he knew about the murders. And right. The easiest way to do that would be to try to get him to reveal that information. So the police decide that they're going to take Jones out of prison, little day trip, and they're going to drive him around. And the Illinois State Police pick him up from his cell, drive him to East St. Louis, where Ronald was found.
Oh, I thought they were going to take him to one of the strip clubs.
No. Police then ask him to show them exactly where the car was parked when it was found. Jones was unable to do it. It was obvious he was not involved. So now they needed him to tell them why in the world he would admit to a murder that he had absolutely nothing to do with. Jones was brought in for a second interrogation, and he told them he was forced to confess. There was a police officer that was looking for a promotion. He gave all the files to Jones and told him that if he didn't confess, the officer would harm his family.
Oh, you're kidding me.
What can you? And this, he was pretty young. He was a younger kid. So he was off the hook.
Right.
He never murdered anybody. So he was doing his jail time so they would leave his family alone. How sad is that?
It's horrible.
They were now free to go after Engelmann as well as Barbara Guswell for the murder of the Guswells and the death of their son, Ronald. Police pay a little visit to Robert Handy, who had up until now not said a word about any of these crimes. The state attorney goes into Handy and they say, hey, we need to make a deal. Because, you know, here's the deal. We have the power to say who gets the death penalty and who does not. Now, which one do you want?
Right.
Obviously, they're realizing he was a lot more involved in this than mm-hmm. first, than just conspiring. They told Handy that the most he would serve would be 14 years with his present sentence.
So not much.
Attended, you know, they would add on the 14. He starts to sing as if he was Jen on the podcast.
Woohoo!
Robert Handy tells investigators that he had first heard of the scheme while visiting Engelmann at his office. A woman named Barbara stopped by and had told Engelmann she had met a man who worked at an oil refinery and they were going to get married. Engelmann told her to take additional policies out on him and, hey, I'll kill him for you. So in essence, as Barbara was signing her wedding license to Ronald, she was also signing his death certificate. How terrible is that? Handy went on to fully discuss the exact details of the night of the murder, including how the three of them were waiting in the garage for Ronald to come home that night, and then they shot him. This was the first time that the officers had heard he was actually killed in the garage. Up until that time, they believed he was killed in East St. Louis.
They shot him or they used a sledgehammer?
They shot him first. Then one man picked up the sledgehammer, which was Engelmann. Police go to the home, which is now owned by somebody else, and they test the garage floor with luminol. Lights up like a Christmas tree on Christmas Eve. Blood is everywhere. From a head wound? Of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
August 10th, 1984, 4.5 years after the murder of Ronald Guswell, officers arrest Barbara Guswell, who is vacationing in Florida. On her, they find a passport and a one-way ticket to Europe.
Huh.
Seems old Babs was keeping up with the news here in St. Louis and was planning her little getaway. Sorry, Babs. Park's closed.
Turn around. Wow.
Right? Barbara Guzman Boyle hires renowned lawyer F. Lee Bailey, but is still convicted of her husband's slaying. Barbara got 50 years, but ended up serving less than half of that, is right around 24 years. She was released in 2009 at the age of 67.
Wow. That's...
Having plenty to go on, the authorities plan to charge Engelmann with the deaths of the Guswell couple, as well as their son, Ronald. To avoid the death penalty, Engelmann finally admits guilt. Engelmann revealed a little bit about himself. He claimed that he had a talent of being able to kill people in cold blood and feel no guilt, no remorse. he thought he would be able to use this talent to earn money. In the quote, but it was something like, everyone has a talent. Athletes play sports, singers sing songs, and everybody makes money off their talent. And my talent is I can kill people in cold blood and feel no guilt or remorse. And I thought, hey, I can make some money off this.
Wow.
Glennon Engelmann was convicted of the murders of 5 people, but suspected of more. He died in prison in 1999 at the age of 71 from complications of diabetes. Dr. Glennon Engelmann was a horror movie come to life. By day, a mild-mannered dentist. By night, for a price, he would take out your worst enemy, and he enjoyed killing more than the money. The end. He did, though. That was not for... He didn't even end up making that much money. He liked the killing. That's what he liked to do.
He liked the killing, but he made over $100,000 on...
Yeah, but he was a dentist. One killing. He made a lot of money anyway.
Well, I know, but still, he didn't...
But the amounts, and I didn't get it because of the money. And I was just going back. It really wasn't. Like, when he was younger, he would kill animals. Mm-hmm. And then he started killing the game, and that just wasn't doing it. He liked the planning, like how we're going to do it, how we're going to, you know.
Right.
And
getting away with it.
The setup. He liked pulling it out. He always thought he was the smartest one in the room, smartest guy in the room.
And he might have enjoyed having these women
Look how many
come to him to kind of save them from their marriage.
There was also, but I only found it one place, that with many of these and like women he would date, they would kind of almost like a dating site. They would choose people together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, make sure you do this and make sure the guy. So for Carmen Miranda,
mm-hmm.
he's like, you need to choose this kind of guy. He needs to be a nice guy that everybody likes. And he needs to be, you know, and
right.
So he would mold them, you know, groom them. And these women would be like, okay.
Dumb women. Don't ever get away with it.
So I believe that they suspect at least he did 3 more, but I could never find what they were.
We'll have to get on that and check it out.
Check it out, girl.
Wow.
Anyway, that's it. I know we got stuff to do. It's our biggest, what do you call it?
Producer. He's proud of the fact.
It's our producer. It's the, what do you call it?
Executive producer.
Throws money at you. No, like our.
Investor?
No, but like. They do it that they're really rich, and this is just like
sugar daddy.
Yes, that's it. No,
he's our sugar daddy.
No, like beside, you know, a philanthropy. There we go.
He's
our podcast is his philanthropy.
Like he's endowed.
He's endowed. All right, woo, woo. Just kidding. Steve.
Yes, he was very proud when he read our Patreon that we just opened, and he's like, "Ooh, this means I'm executive producer, right? I get total control." And I'm like, "You get the same control at the podcast as you get the control at home."
Oh, God, that's not good for him. Anyway, so that's all we got for you. And stay tuned for next week. Jen's got a humdinger.
It's unreal.
It is unreal.
But yes.
So remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love you.
I can't sing.
I do know Little Shop of Horrors. Nope. Or something. No, whatever.
Did I say Vernetta? That's how you say that, right? V-E-R-N-I-T-A. Vernetta.
Vernetta. That seems like it would be.
Okay. Hopefully I said that both times, Nico. Sorry.
Hooked on Phonics works for me.
Not when you have weird names, people. Just go with John Smith.
It's an old name. Or John Snow.
I love John Smith.
I know. Sledge.
How gruesome is that?
Sledgehammer.
Bahabra? Is that how you say it? Bahabra? Bahara? Bahara.
Bahara.
I'm not doing that tongue thing.
Bara.
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 Bara? Barara? Baraha. Baraha. I wrote it for that. Oh, Lord. Maybe I'll just go with Sophie. Here we go. Barara.
Barara.
Baraha. I'm just going to look at
Baraha.
You. I'm
Baraha.
Look at you
and, Baraha.
I'm not saying that. I will mess it up every time. You see, what's Marie? Bahara.
Oh.
Barara. 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 That's it. It's like Barbara. I'm going with Sophie. I'm going to say
you
that
said
again.
Bullocks.
Bullock.
Which is
Bullock.
Another
sorry.
Curse word.
Bullocks. Yeah.
Bullocks. Sorry to offend you, Nico. I know that's a British slang, isn't
it's
it?
It's a bloody British slang. It's what it
bullocks.
Is.
Bloody bollocks.
Okay. We're going to go back here. Sorry. Roof. Roof. Roof.
Roof.
Roof.
The roof.
The roof.
The roof is on fire.
26-year-old.
Get your free M6.
Get never a cavity mind. Filled and your husband killed all in one day.
We do it all.
Sorry.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I'm here to reveal.
Get it out.
No, go ahead. No, Carmen Miranda, that's...
I know.
Somebody must have been a fan.
Handy was that. Handy.
This how is, handy
wait,
was
see, okay, this is funny. I'm going to tell you that. Let me get this out. I'm sorry, Nico. Jennifer's so rude. Okay. I can't even say this guy's name now because it makes me laugh because of you. I mean, it makes me laugh because, again, that sounded like Mark Wahlberg talking really quick like that. You know how he does that? Did you ever say it like when he does it? Like that?
Mm-hmm.
Nico. Nico. Give me an N-I-C-O. Nico. Nico. Nico.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Nico. You deserve better than this. You really do deserve better.
N-I-C-O. N-I-C-O. N-I-C-O.
Oh, Nico,
oh,
you're
Nico,
so fine.
What's his name? Oh.
Oh, Nico, you're so fine. You're so fine. You blow my mind. Hey, Nico. Hey, Nico. Hey, Nico, you're so fine. You make our podcast sound real fine. Hey, Nikki. Nico.